One morning in 2008, a retired nurse arrived for a prayer service at St Mary's Church in Maryborough in Queensland. At the door, she saw a man who was lying under a bench. His leg was splayed out at a really odd angle. Wayne Rooks, a 45-year-old handyman, had died in the grounds of the church early that morning. The church was declared a crime scene. Two men were tracked down by police and charged. The men had met Wayne Rooks for the first time the evening before. They'd all been drinking heavily. At around 7 p.m, they'd gone into the grounds of St Mary's to smoke a joint. And it was there that the two men bashed Wayne Rooks, kicked him repeatedly with steel-capped boots, before leaving him to die. When the men were brought to trial, they used a legal defence called gay panic. They claimed a homosexual advance had provoked them to violence. But Wayne Rooks wasn't gay, and he hadn't made a pass at them that night. Father Paul Kelly was the priest at St Mary's at the time. Father Kelly was appalled that gay panic was still on the books as a legitimate defence in the state of Queensland for violent crime, particularly when it was being used so spuriously. And so Father Paul Kelly embarked on a 5-year campaign to change the law. Father Paul Kelly, hello.
Hello, Richard.
Where were you when you got the call about the death of Wayne Rooks?
I was in Gympie, an hour away from Maryborough, coming back from an ordination in Brisbane. I never went to a lot of the church functions because it was so far away in the country and we didn't have a lot of backup. So I sort of just stayed in the parish and worked away. But I thought I better go down to this ordination and show my face. So I was coming back from the ordination the night before, and I was in a fast food restaurant having a bacon and egg sandwich, and I got a call from the police saying, your church is a crime scene.
What did they tell you they'd found there?
Well, I initially said, oh, it hasn't been burnt down, has it? Because we'd had a lot of vandalism. But they said, no, a body had been found in the grounds and it looked suspicious. And I immediately thought, well, is it a parishioner? Who is it? They probably thought it was me because I wasn't around. So there was all sorts of questions. And being an hour away, I got in the car as quickly as I could. And it was the longest hour drive back.
Could they tell you who the victim was at that time?
No, I didn't hear who it was for days later, really.
And what was going on in the church at the time that the body was discovered?
It should have been a morning mass at 8 o'clock that morning, but because I was at the ordination, it converted to a prayer service led by lay people. So they were rolling in at 8 and a few people walked past the body because there was a man sleeping rough out there all the week prior, and unbeknownst to everyone else, I'd given him money to go to Sydney and he'd disappeared. But the next day, a man was found dead and they thought it was the same person sleeping.
All right, they just thought he was a homeless person asleep at the time. So what happened when you arrived back at the church in Maryborough?
I couldn't go anywhere near the church. My presbytery and office is just beside the church, and I was stuck in there, not able to cross the police line. The parishioners who found the body were still in the grounds talking to the police. They couldn't talk to anyone. I couldn't talk to them. So I spent the time pacing up and down, really very stressed and worried and feeling helpless.
And how long were your parishioners kept in the area, kept inside the church?
I think it was 2 or 3 hours, and slowly the police talked to them one by one and let them go, leaving their cars behind because it was all in the scene.
Whereabouts exactly was the body found? And why did you think that position was kind of, you know, significant in terms of the actual space of the church?
He was in a covered area at the side entrance of the church next to the car park. So it was right near the side door, and there was a little park bench in that undercovered area, and he was sort of underneath it. His body was there all day, and all I could see is watch the security footage on the screen. And so from 8 a.m. in the morning till about 6 or 7 at night, the body had to be kept there while the police and forensic people investigated, and that itself was very distressing. And then the police did their best to clean up, but when they finally vacated the premises, a police officer said, oh, you might like to get a bucket and wash it down. We did our best. And so I went out to the side and tried to hose it down well, and I just you know, it wasn't a grotesque scene, but it was just sad, very sad.
Yeah, sounds a bit nightmarish, actually, the whole thing. Were your parishioners in some distress over the whole thing too?
They were pretty calm, actually. Obviously, it was upsetting for them, and I'm very grateful that the lady who worked out that he wasn't just a man sleeping was a very well-experienced nurse, and she took control and was very calm about it. But I think it did affect everybody, and it just ingrained that we wanted to know what happened and why this horrible thing had happened in our grounds and in a place of sanctuary. Anyway, I went out and put a little flower where he lay, which happened to be right opposite a station of the cross where it said Jesus was placed in the tomb. So it just was a coincidence, but the poignancy of it just struck me. And we offered masses up for this nameless person all that weekend. I said, look, the intention for this church service today is this poor man who's died and his family.
So, Paul, you said it was a few days before his identity was made known to you. Did you know him or his family? I mean, Maryborough's not a big town, but did you know them?
No, apparently he'd only just come into town in the days beforehand. I'd never met him before, and I'd never met the mother who lived in Caboolture. But I wondered, I thought, well, is this someone I know initially? That unknown, even as I was pacing the presbytery, I thought, I can see how you can get almost PTSD from not even seeing the scene or not being right there, because the helplessness, the unknown, the wondering, the fear, all of that just played terrible tricks on my mind. I really think that affected me deeply, which I felt guilty about because I wasn't on the scene. I was just next to it. But the helplessness really, really affected me.
Once police began to investigate who might have done this, were you able to help them?
Yes, and that was a great relief. I had been pushing to have security footage put in the grounds of the church because we'd had a lot of vandalism. There was almost not a week where we didn't have someone smash a window in.
What, stained glass window?
Yes, yeah. Lead light, and we had low, very large windows that people would put a brick through every week, a different window. So I'd been pushing to have security footage and eventually got it put in. I tried a few cheaper alternatives, like I stuck a baby monitor into the church and it transmitted 50 metres to my bedroom. It was the most demanding baby I've ever heard of because it kept waking me up every time there was a sound.
So you had some security footage.
Yes.
So what did the security footage reveal?
Well, I, in an attempt to do something when I felt quite useless in the situation, I went looking up the security footage to see if I could find when this had happened, because even that wasn't known. It turned out it was about 7 o'clock the night before, and he was found 8 a.m. the next morning. This is July, so it was a very cold night. I looked at the security footage, and it had the two attackers standing in the treed area beside the church, and Wayne came walking down from the pub and talked to them at a distance. He was never very close to them. And then one of them lunged at him and he ran away and walked across the road and disappeared. And I'm shouting at the security footage saying, yeah, go, leave. I had already known what must have happened. Then he comes back about 5 minutes later, walking back down. I think he was trying to get to the shops on the other side and he thought he'd left enough time for them to go away, and he'd walked right back to the same two people. And one of them lunged at him, and this time they caught up with him on the corner of the church, and he went under the undercover area near that chair, and you could see movement as if there was sort of attacking going on. And then the two men shortly after walked around a few times, hands on heads, and walked away, and he never emerged.
So you could see the two men going, oh my God, what have we done? That's
yes,
what it looked
yes.
like.
Yes, they looked like they were kind of going, oh, we've really injured him, and yeah, they looked panicked, but paced up and down and then just walked off.
How quickly were police able to find these two men who'd killed Wayne Rooks then?
Within about 48 hours, they'd caught the men. I believe the security footage we provided actually helped, because one of the men had a very distinctive fluorescent work shirt.
Oh dear.
Mm. And even though the footage wasn't extremely clear, it was in colour, and the police then linked it up with other footage around town and other pubs, which filmed from the outside as well as people walking past. And this is where I was really fascinated. I thought, well, how can... They can't see who the people were in this sort of blurry darkness, but they were drinking, so when a drinking container was placed down, they saw where it was and went to it and got fingerprints. If they leant against a wall, they went to that wall and did forensics. So it wasn't just what they saw on the screen, but showed them where all the movement had happened, and they really honed in on it, which I was extremely fascinated by.
So in 2010, the trial began. And were you called to give evidence in court?
I was possibly going to be called, because I was the controller of the security footage. So I was a potential witness to say this security footage was taken at this time and it is what it is. So I thought to myself, well, I don't know. I mean, witnesses aren't sort of supposed to be sitting in on trial. So I thought I better just keep away from it. So I followed it from the media.
At the trial, the defence lawyers made the claim that Wayne Rooks had come onto them. There'd been some kind of homosexual advance made towards them. What were they alleging?
Well, I wondered that. I thought, "What? Why is this being brought up?" That was my first reaction. Why is this relevant? Why is the judge not saying, sorry, stop there? I realised later that you could raise that kind of thing in a court case, because it was still part of the law, so it couldn't be stopped from being said. But I was confused. I thought, why is this relevant? What does that have anything to do with? Plus, I also thought that's a load of rubbish.
Because you'd seen the footage, hadn't you?
I'd seen the footage, yeah. And one of the attackers said he grabbed my crotch. Well, he never came anywhere near them. I thought, this is rubbish. Why is this relevant? And even if he had touched him, how does that justify an extreme overreaction of violence and then leaving him lying all night unaided?
So they were using a defence that used to be quite common in Australia, of homosexual panic, gay panic. How did the victim's mother react to the raising of this gay panic defence?
Well, I was very interested in that, because her reaction was swift and immediate. She was on the steps of the court saying, my son wasn't gay, he had a girlfriend, and this shouldn't even be sort of a thing. And my heart went out to her. I thought, oh, she's lost her son, and now she's feeling she has to stand up and defend his reputation. So I thought, she's intuitively picked up that somehow this is pejorative to his case.
Now, the defence would have seen all the evidence the prosecution did. They would have seen that videotape. They knew perfectly well there was no substance in this allegation. So why raise it anyway?
Apparently, a police officer, on the night one of them was arrested, went into the lockup claiming to be another prisoner and got one of the attackers talking, and they said, you know, oh, that man tried all this gay stuff.
Right.
So the thing is, whether one of them really did believe that, but there was no evidence of it. So yes, it confused me. I don't understand.
What was the verdict that was handed down to those?
The verdict was not guilty of murder, guilty of manslaughter. So when it came down to the fineries of law, they couldn't prove intent. So one of the objections when I jumped up and down about this is, oh, well, in the end, that defence didn't have to apply, because it only applies if you're found guilty, and except for that defence, you're guilty of murder, you can be found guilty of manslaughter. So there was splitting of hairs by saying, look, it was mentioned, but it wasn't pleaded formally, and it wasn't the final determinant.
What? Hang on a second. So they mentioned it,
yes,
but didn't advance it, in other words,
that's how I understand it. But my reaction to that was, once it's got into the creek, it's muddied the waters, you cannot... The jury doesn't announce, how it made its decision. So nobody knows on what basis people form their opinions.
So it's like those cases where someone's on a rape trial, perhaps, and the defence lawyer will say something like, "Yeah, well, what about that short skirt you were wearing?" And the judge might rule that as, you know, or that it might be objected to. But it's been said, hasn't it?
That's right.
Yeah. It's,
and that was my reaction, is once you've mentioned it, it can tap into deep-seated phobias and presumptions that I think are quite lethal, actually, in this day and age.
What was the reaction to the crime and the verdict like in Maryborough? I mean, I'm sure everyone in town was talking about it.
I think the general reaction was, what a ridiculous situation this is, that there's been this brutal action and no attempt to get assistance for the person. And suddenly, you know, they seem to be getting off lighter.
We know that in country Australia, it's very difficult for people to be gay. They often subject to a lot of, you know, discrimination and violence, verbal abuse. How are things like that in a town like Maryborough?
Well, I'd been in a town near Maryborough before this, Mergen, which is near Kingaroy. And someone from Kingaroy told me a story when I was a priest there. And to this day, I don't really know why they told me this story, but I just arrived in Mergen. And they said, oh, there was a doctor who came to town in Kingaroy, and he was very much loved and respected. And one day he came out as gay, and he got rejected, and eventually he killed himself. And I thought, right, okay, that's really awful. And, you know, this is just one of those, it's not funny, but I'm laughing because I just thought, this is one of those anecdotal cautionary tales, it seemed to me. So I thought to myself, is this what's told to everybody to let them know?
Oh, right, yeah, keep your mouth shut.
Keep your mouth shut. Now, okay, so, but look, I didn't experience that in Mergen. And Maryborough, I felt, was quite enlightened, actually. Like, when I got there, I was interested that they had a diversity night, which was a local pub once a month, I think it was. People of diverse backgrounds came together and celebrated, and they dressed up. And I thought, well, this is, you know, this is a country town that seems to be, you know, quite tolerant. But there was a man who was bashed up in town, and the first report said that a group of people set upon this man, and what was said to him was, you're from that diversity night. And then he got seriously bashed up. When it went to trial, I was very interested to notice that that was never mentioned again. That whole element had not been raised, but the diversity night didn't really last long after that. And I just thought, I wonder if there is an undercurrent of intolerance and fear there.
Is there a problem with having such crimes recognised as hate crimes then?
Well, that's right, because when someone reports to the police that they've been bashed up, it doesn't say now, can you tick, was this a hate crime or was it a drunken rampage? Like, so there's no statistics unless it's specifically looked for to see whether there's some other things going on underneath it.
There was another case that happened soon after in the region. Tell me how that played out.
Very similar situation. A hitchhiker was picked up by two men south of Maryborough and bashed up by them and then dragged into the bush and left there, and he died. When the two men were caught, one of them said that the man grabbed him sexually and he lost control and beat him and then dragged him into the bushes and he died. And at that point I thought, this is only months after the first case, this is ridiculous. What is the chances of two of the same situations happening in the space of about 3 months? So I just couldn't comprehend it.
One of the things that makes this kind of such an unusual thing for you particularly is that you got to observe the unfolding of a real-life killing at close hand at your church. The thing is, you've always been a massive murder mystery fan, haven't you?
That's right. It's quite ironic, really.
And how long have you been such a massive murder mystery fan?
Oh, since I was about 9, I read Sherlock Holmes, all of the short stories. Very hard to read because they're in such old English language. Mm-hmm. Agatha Christie's from a very early age. Loved them. Yeah, so I've always been interested in murder mysteries. And No, I thought they were very entertaining reads.
Well, they certainly are. Did you try writing some yourself?
I did. I got a typewriter when I was about 10 years old and typed up my little murder mysteries and mystery stories. And then I started recording them onto tape and making them into little radio plays.
How old were you when you were doing this?
I started doing it when I was about 10 years old.
Right, writing your own radio dramas.
Yeah.
And who did you cast in these radio dramas?
My poor, unsuspecting brothers and my sister, who were all locked into a darkened room with no air to make it all quiet.
Were they keen?
No, not really. One of my brothers got me to sign a contract that he wouldn't have to do them anymore.
Right. Sorry, to sign a contract so you wouldn't have to do
that. No, that's right. He was fed up with it.
Right. The contracts normally go the other way, don't they?
Like I made it, and I've still got them, funnily enough, about 25 episodes of them and did them over several years and I'd write them out. We would edit them. So if we made a mistake, we'd do a line like 20 times until we got it right and I'd drop it in, all manually in the old days where you'd have to pause a tape and copy it over.
And what did you use for sound effects?
We'd make our own, like I'd crush cellophane to make fire. I used a hairdryer for a plane. I'd pull a hairdryer away. When we got older, I'd get records. You know, the BBC might have a record and they'd have some sound effects, but I actually liked doing our own. I didn't have a theme tune, so I wrote one and added sound effects.
And what's the tone like?
It was really creepy. Was it? Like it was a piano kind of ding, ding.
And how did these dramas evolve over time as the years went by?
Well, I've always had a bit of a sense of humour, so they became humorous. I couldn't help not turning it into a bit of a comedy. My brother used to say, oh, you're only saying it's a comedy because it's no good. And that way you can say it's meant to be funny. But I think we were aiming for some humour.
So with all this kind of this love and devotion to murder mysteries, to reading them and creating your own, years and years later, there you are in the middle of a real one. How different was it? How shocking was it to be in the middle of a real murder mystery?
It was terrible. And I'd actually commented to a few people, like, murder mysteries, books and TV shows, they're enjoyable. The real thing, there's not one bit that's enjoyable. It ruins everybody's lives who's in it. Nobody's the same again. So the difference between a real life incident and fiction is just worlds apart. The only thing I took some peace out of was trying to help to find out what happened. I still to this day like those true crime shows, but I discovered I really like it when they show how they solved it, and I really don't like it if they say this is unsolved. I can't stand that. The real thing was just terrible, and people just don't really ever get over it, even if you're just on the edges of it. You really don't really, you're never quite the same. Because I'm interested in writing and audio and production, I'd sometimes look at the books in to see how the plot was developed, or I'd watch a show to see how they put it together. So sometimes my interest was more technical. I still like a good murder mystery, but occasionally I've seen some shows that where all of the characters end up going away and nobody's really benefited, you know, nobody's come out of it very well. And that struck a chord with me. I thought, that's the real feeling, where you're sorry for the victim, you're sorry for all those who got exposed to it, and you're sorry for the people who did it, because it's just pathetic and it's ruined lives. So that's the real reality of crime.
Listening to Conversations with Richard Feidler.
Now, we were just talking before about you as a kid liking murder mysteries and creating your own radio dramas. How come we're not, you know, how come you're not a colleague? How come you're not working for the ABC, Father Kelly, and going into the priesthood instead?
I don't know. I think I've always been a frustrated actor, a frustrated radio technician, a frustrated detective.
Maybe if you worked here, you'd say, I've always been a frustrated priest.
Yeah, yeah. I at one point, I did think, okay, you've got all these interests and they all seem really good. But I thought, actually, the things I like to do, like radio and writing and music and that, they're almost a hobby. So I think I can keep doing that and still be a priest. So I wanted to do it all. If I wasn't a priest, I reckon I'd also be a waiter, because I actually like the service industry. I just like being of service, not being a slave, but of really serving people.
This is what I hear from a lot of people on this program. That's the secret of happiness, is seeing yourself as a servant, funnily enough. Even some very wealthy and powerful people have told me they see themselves as servants in the past, which is a nice idea. I think it tends to give shape to one's life. So how did your parents react when you said, I want to join the priesthood?
They were, I think, the perfect combination. They were very reserved. They didn't say, oh, wonderful. They also didn't say, don't do it. So I didn't ever feel like I was doing it to please them or doing it to spite them, which was great, because my mother's eldest brother is a priest. He's a retired priest now. So there had been priests in the family, and he's had a wonderful ministry and life. But it's a difficult life, as everyone knows. So I think my mum was very cautious for me to really know what I was getting into. I did well at university, so I went and studied law and economics. Then when I was finishing that, it was suggested to me, well, go and try and be a article clerk. And I said, well, look, a policeman doesn't go and try to be a teacher before they realise they want to be a policeman. So why can't I, if I want to be a priest and I've done the study, I think it's time to actually go and do it. It's just something I always wanted to do.
It wouldn't have been seen as a popular choice at the time to join the priesthood. The environment at the time, the people around you, they would have probably, I don't know, how did they react to all that?
Well, at university, with my law colleagues, I was very secretive about it, and I was going to meetings to discern priesthood. So when I went to graduate, they said, oh, we either thought you were going to be a priest or an ASIO person. It was just not something I wanted to spread around that I was doing.
Right. So how long did you study in the seminary for? How long does one do that for?
7 years. We were the last of the Bagneux Seminary students that went right through the Pius XII Seminary from beginning to end. And they're still there now under the ACU, Australian Catholic University, but they moved away and came back. So
I think most people imagine a kind of monastic existence in a seminary, like you live in a kind of stone cell on a rock, on a bed made out of stone, and you might get the Bible to read, and that might be about it, and maybe Thomas Aquinas and all that. Is that how it is?
It was at one point fairly simple rooms with a few books and very rigid monastic rules. The building continued to be monastic, but the way they trained us was very different. So the building and the structure didn't match with the modern way of being in the community and working with people. So it was discordant.
Given that you wanted to serve people, I suppose that must have been not an easy time. Nonetheless, is there something to be said for that life of stillness, in our kind of hyper-stimulated world that we live in? Is there something to be said for that?
Absolutely. There are a lot of people who, from the beginning of their morning to the very last notes of their day, there's noise or music or something or busyness. So there really is a need for stillness and silence.
How do you feel a calling for it? Is it something that's inspired, or is it something you just kind of arrive at through reason?
I think it's an attraction. It is by reason as well as by interest. Since I was about four, I just was very attracted to the idea of priesthood and church. So obviously that was just a very young impression. I kept praying to God, oh, give me a clear sign that this is what you want me to do, because I don't want to make a mistake. I don't want to, you know, choose a difficult life and find it wasn't the right one. And I just got this very vague impression after years of praying about it. Oh, well, if that's what you want to do, that'd be good. Which made me laugh, because I thought, oh, okay, so if I wanted to do radio or acting or that'd be all right too, would it? Like, it really, but it was enough for me to go, okay, well, that's it. It's what you feel drawn to and feel that you're going to be able to come alive in.
What's the actual day-to-day business of being a priest like in a town like Maryborough, where you're not there anymore, but you're in the Gold Coast these days, but to be in a country town like that where people come to you and want to tell you about what's going on in their lives?
It's really beautiful because you're actually welcomed into the deepest part of people's lives when people are being born, when they're very ill, when they're celebrating special commitments like weddings or anniversaries, when they're dying, after they've died. So right throughout significant moments of people's lives, they're saying, we usually draw our family around us, but please come in and be part of that. So,
what about the darker aspects when someone's coming to you saying, my husband's beating me, or I think my child's becoming a heroin addict, or this kind of thing?
It's really confronting because these are very difficult issues and people are really suffering in them. But I've always thought, well, I could run away and pretend it's not happening and it's still happening to them. So I think this is happening to people's lives. If I could be somehow with them without pretending I've got all the answers, then that they might be able to get just some extra strength and support at a time when maybe nothing else can be done. You know, we don't always agree with our colleagues. I remember a lady coming to me years ago and saying, you know, she'd left her husband because he was very, very violent. And she said that some old priest from down south had rung her and said, you know, it's your duty to get back with him. And I said to her, well, that priest is wrong and that is awful. But I thought that's an act of evil doing that. And that's actually, yeah, so that made me mad.
So fast forward now to 2008 in Maryborough, and we'll come full circle here now to the discovery of Wayne Rooks' body outside your church, the trial. At the time, Queensland was one of the last states in Australia to allow for homosexual panic as a defence when it came to violent crime. How did you go about deciding to take a stand on this?
I'm kind of a bit like a dog with a bone. I heard those things raised in the case and I was confused. So I wrote to the Attorney General and basically said, why is all of this allowed in a case like that? And I got a response back, a polite one, that didn't really explain much to me.
This would have been in, what, the Beattie government, Anna Bligh's
yes.
government years, that period?
Yes.
Yeah.
And then I looked up a newspaper and there was a law professor who was campaigning about the gay panic defence. And I thought, well, this really is a thing. So I found his email and emailed him and he said, yes, I've been trying to get rid of this law for ages. I said, well, look, there's two situations right here. And he said, get a petition. And I've done petitions in the past, which involve printing up, you know, lined pieces of paper and handing them out. And you'd get, oh, if you had a good day, you'd have 100 people and you'd think that was wonderful. So I was thinking, oh, if I got a couple of 100 people, that'd be nice. I didn't think we needed more than one, actually, because it was so stupid, this law. But he suggested, go online and do an e-petition. So I went on there, didn't know what I was doing, and just wrote something up and posted it. And within a very short time, it was entering the thousands.
Thousands, and then more, and then more, and then more. So.
And then Stephen Fry.
Stephen Fry spoke up. Stephen Fry from QI, from legend of British comedy.
Yeah, he basically reposted the petition with very little comment, but that got tens of thousands of people.
So this was all petition hosted by change.org.
Yes.
How many people signed on to this petition in the end?
Over 290,000.
290,000 people from all over the world, I assume that would be.
Yes.
Did the church hierarchy know you were doing this? Were they aware of this?
They were aware of it. When you're made a priest in a particular region, they trust you to get in and deal with the issues that relate to that area. So people have said, well, did you go and ask permission? I said, no, because, you know, you respond as needed. If it was something I thought was utterly inconsistent with the Catholic Church and might embarrass, you know, the bishop, I wouldn't have done it. But I honestly couldn't see what was wrong with defending human life and dignity.
Were people surprised that a priest was pushing for this change?
A lot of people were very surprised, and maybe I'm a bit silly, but I couldn't understand what the big deal was.
Well, I mean, there has been a lot of criticism of the church about its stance towards whether homosexuality is acceptable. You can see why people would be surprised to see a priest coming out against this kind of defence of homosexual panic.
Well, I suppose, but to me, I was thinking, well, okay, does that mean people have the perception that we actually would stand there and approve them being beaten and killed? Because that's shocking. And then I thought, well, we've probably got a problem with communication if people actually think we approve of violence and killing.
People being kicked to death next to your church.
Yeah. People we don't agree with see the same things on.
So there was a bit of suspicion from progressive people, but was there also some problems the other way? Did you get hate mail?
Very little. Actually, I was surprised. By far, like 99% of people were supportive in the church and in the wider community. Almost everybody was saying, this is great, this is the gospel in action. It's great to see someone standing up for a common sense issue. One or two creepy emails or messages from people were sort of saying, why are you so interested in that? And one person suggested that maybe it was because we defend pedophilia or something that would be supporting gays. And I didn't really even know what he was talking about. So the rare comments were really odd and just seemed to be totally out of left field.
So after having been sort of fobbed off by the state's attorney general in 2008-2009, once you had this petition, what happened when you presented that to the politicians at the time?
Well, for a while there, they wouldn't actually refer to it. This wasn't an issue. This isn't a law. If you look at the law, it doesn't say gay anywhere under the provocation defence, which made me very annoyed because even a basic legal knowledge would know it doesn't have to be on the surface of the law to be actually applicable, and it's in the common law and hasn't been excluded.
So do you think the government was being a bit disingenuous then?
I believe so, and I couldn't see any other reason for them not changing it immediately.
Given that they were trying to fob you off and hoping you'd just go away, did that have the opposite effect upon you?
I did feel a little bit foolish, and I never like feeling foolish, and it did make me think, you know, well, maybe I don't know what I'm talking about, but that was only a temporary feeling. It did make me think, no, the more they're resisting without a very good reason, the more I feel I'm really onto something here, and there's something really wrong here, and it needs to be changed.
So then there was a change of government. Campbell Newman, the new Conservative Premier of Queensland, was elected, and he had an Attorney General, Jared Blay. How did your meeting with him go?
It was awkward. We had a meeting in a little room in the entrance of the Queensland Parliament. Jared Blay had several assistants with him and they all had notes. And I walked in there. I had a few notes in my pocket, but I thought, no, I'm not going to bring out these notes and get into a huge slanging match over it. But I did feel like it was a bit like a Year 12 debating competition where someone, you know, says, see, I showed you there, and you think that wasn't actually a very good point. But
you're actually trained as a lawyer, aren't you?
I mean, did, and I never mentioned it. I don't think they ever knew. So when they were saying, you don't really understand, leave this to the experts, I don't pretend to be an expert having studied it but not practiced it. But I thought, no, I think even an ordinary person, which is the test usually in law, has a very good idea of what's reasonable.
Jared Blay is a young man and a conservative Christian. What did he make of you, do you think?
Well, I said to him, you know, this is just about basic human rights, you know. This isn't some kind of agenda if you're feeling resistant because, you know, you don't want to be associated with particular agendas. And he said, oh, yeah, but they're taking it on. I said, wouldn't you if you're being bashed to death?
Who's there? Who are they?
Well, I think it was gays.
Right. So that meant you ought not to take it on.
Well,
in his mind.
I felt that meant I'm resistant because it seems to be getting caught up in the gay agenda. I'm thinking, well, look, As I said to him, as you know, the Catholic Church is not renowned for its promotion of gay rights. So I'm just speaking on behalf of human rights, and that this is clearly an anomaly in one group's basic human rights to be feeling safe. But I did feel the resistance was because it was associated with what they felt was an ideology that they didn't want to be promoting.
So what was the turning point?
Well, after that meeting, I thought, I don't think I'm going to get anywhere. And they said, we're not going to change it. And then I thought to myself, well, that means we have to wait till another person dies and this defence is used, which to me was disgusting.
Or for a change of government.
Or a change of government, although both... the Labor government had finally said that it would make some changes and then got kicked out. I said to myself and to the people on the petition, we're going to keep this ticking over. I don't care if it ever changes. We're just going to keep that running. We're not going to go away. And the numbers will just keep going up as a constant reminder that people are watching and they're not happy. And I felt that that was unsettling and in a good way. The watching eye is a very hard thing to ignore.
So there was another change of government. The Newman government lasted 3 years. Labor was surprisingly brought back into office. Did that suddenly open the possibility of change again?
Yes, because they had committed to making changes. And so in the petition, I encouraged people to ask if they were going to continue to honour that. The Labor government said that by the end of 2015, they would change the law. And then the end of 2015 came and it hadn't changed. So then sometime in 2016, they said by the end of the year, it would change. And I'm saying, well, look, why is there such a delay? Why is there so much resistance? And I thought, if they don't change it by the end of the year, I'm going to really jump up and down. Well, I got reminded that there were 2 weeks left before Parliament rose. Again, got on the petition and said, everybody, ask where that promise went. And they introduced it on the second last day of sittings of 2016.
Why the reluctance here? This isn't hard, is it? Put Queensland in line with other states.
Well, to use a good example, in New Zealand, provocation has been used badly in a number of different areas, like violent men who were informed by their wife that she was leaving him because he was violent. At one point, that was used as provocation, the fact that they were leaving them, to say that they lost control. Well, of course, in recent cases, including one in New Zealand, where someone tried to use that defence, it was howled out of court and the law changed overnight because it was wrong.
It was a long campaign of many, many years. Did it take its toll?
Yes. At the height of the attention, I felt like just crawling under my bed and wishing everything would go away. A lot of my friends and colleagues, I'm very familiar with media because I've had an interest in it. And I think some people mistook that for, you know, being a bit of a media tart, as I've been called. And I couldn't convince them that this wasn't something I was pushing to have. And in fact, I was actually deeply going, I think I'm about to fall over from the intensity of it, the stress. But I thought, I'm the best placed person to push this because it happened right on my doorstep and I can't let go. But I was exhausted, absolutely exhausted.
And when the law was changed?
I was relieved but exhausted. And I thought, good.
Now you can get on with your life.
Yeah.
Do something else for a change. You met with Wayne Rook's mother. How was that experience?
It was beautiful but moving and tragic because Joyce seemed haunted naturally by the death of her son and could not believe that justice had been done to him and that this law had somehow affected his reputation.
Was she supportive of your campaign?
Yes. There was a very fine line. I realised that this wasn't my grief and that Joyce standing up for her son, I didn't want to feel as if I was taking that over as something, an aspect of a campaign I was running. And she was quite clear. She said, look, I realise there's this gay panic defence, but he wasn't gay. And I said, look, I fully appreciate that. That's why this law is insane. You could be thought to be gay, you could be suspected of being gay, or they could just make up that you were gay. All of those situations are rubbish and shouldn't matter whether one is or not. The fact that he wasn't gay is just another nail in the coffin of this whole issue.
And just finally, the two men who killed Wayne Rooks, who went to jail for it. The scriptures sort of teach you that you can't shun even people like that. You've still got to stand beside them and accept that they're still human beings. How do you feel about those men?
Well, that's a very good question, because, look, there have been times where I stopped and thought, has this campaign been at the expense of compassion also for those who've done the wrong thing?
You think they're deserving of compassion?
I didn't see a lot of compassion shown or any mercy, but I don't feel any hatred or resentment towards them. I feel sadness and just a sense of tragedy. I don't think society deals very well with the fact that we've got victims and perpetrators and that everybody loses out. That's not a popular concept, but yeah, my heart goes out to everyone whose life was destroyed, including those who acted so destructively.
Finally, what have you learned about making political change in Australia?
If you really believe in it and you stick by it, even when you get this, that's a load of rubbish, you know, what would you know? If you stick at it and you really believe in it, you can make a difference.
Father Paul Kelly, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Conversations with Richard Feidler. Broadcasts, podcasts, and online.
Don't forget you can listen to any of these conversations on our website, abc.net.au/conversations. I'm Richard Feidler.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website, abc.net.au/conversations.